See what we've got here. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I don't know why, it's always the first question which I always pick up. Thank you for being such a wonderful teacher. You have been working so hard, and it's been nearly a decade since you took some time off. With the arrival of your 60th birthday, would you consider taking a few months off? This would be the best gift that all your disciples can give you as a birthday gift, not to be demanding of your time for a few months, so you can body and can have a good rest. Would you let me? Nice idea. But when, it's a Mark Twain said, when your vocation is your vacation, then you're a happy person. So now it's because you enjoy what you're doing. So it is a holiday. Next question. Does a Sotapanna know when he becomes a stream winner? What about she? Does it mean that Sotapannas cannot become stream, she's can't become Sotapannas? Does a Sotapanna know when they become a stream enterer? Similarly with the other three higher stages, Sakadagami, Anagami, and Arahat. Do they know for sure when they reach that stage? And can they be mistaken? Okay, it said by the time I thought I was an Arahat, enlightened. You know that story, you asked for it, so here it comes. It's 4 years I'd been a monk. And I was in this lovely monastery in the north of Thailand. And it was northeast of Thailand. You had no duties. And I was really going for broke. Meditating late into the night. Walking, sitting. And the mind was getting more and more peaceful. Until one evening. One evening walking meditation. You got so peaceful. So still. That all these insights came pouring into you. You just understood things. Everything made so much sense. And you're getting more inspired until the big one came. Wow! That was it. Fully enlightened. At last. And it felt like it. Everything just saw right through everything. There was nothing left. You had incredible bliss. Now this was in northeast time. You were hardly sleeping at all. And I never wanted to sleep. It was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. About 2 o'clock in the morning, sorry. You decided, well, you should sleep. So you just went down and laid down on your bed. You didn't go to sleep. And I knew the bell was going to ring at 3 o'clock. So it was 2:30. I was back in the hall, meditating. And usually when you 3:15, the bell rings at 3 o'clock, usually 3:15 when you start meditating, your head's down. It's tough. You know, in the jungles it's hot, you know, you're malnourished. But that morning, no problem at all. No hindrances, no sleeping, not even a thought in the mind. Perfectly still for hours. Blissed out. Oh, it was just so wonderful being enlightened. It's a shame it didn't last that long. Because what happened next? If you haven't read that story. What happened next? I was just really high, and you went on arms round in the morning, and every person who put food into my bowl, I just zapped them with real mega giga meta. They were so lucky because they gave the first food to a newly born Arahat. And when we got back to the monastery, because you'd only get rice on alms round, it was the locals, they would cook the food for you. And it was always the same every day. You know, the rains retreat. You had the sort of sticky rice, you know, on alms round, and you'd have, it was called rotten fish curry, plaid egg. And it was rotten fish. Because what they would do, this was the rains retreat. Rainy season. That was the fish from the year before. And they'd collect it all and they'd put it in an earthen jar and they'd just put a bit of plastic over the top to let it sort of go rotten. And that's the only way they could preserve it. And you know, it smelt terrible and it tasted worse than it smelt. And that's what you got every day, pradek, the rotten fish curry, always the same. But that morning, I couldn't believe my eyes, there were two pots there. One was the rotten fish curry, and the other one was a pork curry somebody had made. Like, I wouldn't call it delicious, I'd call it edible, because the other one wasn't. You had to eat it anyway. And for the first time I'd seen in that couple of months, you'd seen something which had actually smelt nice. And of course I figured it out straight away. It's obvious. The heavenly beings had seen what had happened the night before. And they also wanted to make merit with a new arahat. So it's obvious to me. But then, after giving the blessing, because there's only about 6 monks in this monastery, what you do there is, there's only 2 pots, so you just, they put them in front of the abbot, and he takes his and pass it down. And so, obviously the abbot, he saw that pork curry. And I couldn't believe they made these huge ladles, not small ladles, but 3 incredibly huge ladles. No one could eat that much. But I didn't mind, because there's plenty left for me. But what he did next, it was just unbelievable. He'd taken 3 big scoops of this pork curry and put it into his bowl. He didn't take any of the rotten fish curry, even though he's a local boy, he grew up on this stuff. But instead, he took the rest of the pork curry and poured it all in to the rotten fish curry and stirred it all up. This is true, no exaggeration. He said, it's all the same. It's all the same. Mungan, mungan leo. And I thought, if it was all the same, why didn't he stir it up together before he got his stuff out? And he's just a greedy pig. And he's taken away my ceremonial, celebratory pork curry. And that's just not on. And Abba's not supposed to do that. I mean, it didn't make any sense. And I realized, monks aren't supposed to have greed. No, arahats, enlightened beings, were not supposed to get angry and worry about pork curry. That was such a terrible feeling. When you think you're enlightened and then you find out you ain't. That was the time I was enlightened. It didn't last for very long. It was good fun though. So, do you know that you become a stream enterer? Look, what are the signs? If you're thinking about breakfast tomorrow morning, you're not enlightened. So no, for stream entry it's hard to know, but it's if you think that there is a self somewhere, some place, you're not a stream winner. So this is to see very clearly there's nobody in here, and at the end of your existence you're going to totally disappear, not get reborn somewhere, not be in some cosmic consciousness. Not going into some place where everybody merges together, but to see that everything just disappears and vanishes. You're gone. And you realize that because there was never anyone here to begin with. Like, for example, I was giving this seminar with my friend Abbot Placid, who's a Benedictine monk, and Professor David Blair, he was the head of physics in UWA, on spirituality and science. And during that debate, because there's an old question, where did this universe come from? Because this stuff here, cups, water, where did it come from? Because one of the basic laws of physics, the conservation of energy, really mass energy, you can't get something out of nothing. So, I sort of asked him, I know there is something in science, I said, called negative energy. Potential energy, if you remember your high school science, is a form of negative energy. Because to take this bottle of water and take it into outer space, away and beyond the Earth's gravitational field, you have to take energy away. So any massive object in a gravitational field exhibits negative energy. And I asked the professor, what would it be like if all the positive energy in the universe completely balanced the negative energy so the sum total is zero? And he looked at me and he was very impressed. I remember that look. Wow, you're a monk and you're so up to date. It was only a very recent finding. Omega, he said, equals one. And omega is very much, is defined as the balance or the ratio of positive to negative energy in the universe. And so I said, well, if that's the case, that means there's actually nothing here. It's just negative energy and positive energy. It came from nothing. If you bring it all together again, there's nothing. That's how we can get a universe out of nothing. Because there's nothing here. And it will all go back to nothing again. Just like your stream of consciousness. There's nothing here. My mother must be very wise, because she often said, Peter, there's nothing between your ears, you're stupid. She was right. That's why everyone who's coming to this retreat, you're not coming here to attain things. You're coming here to lose things, to vanish, to disappear. So the definition of an arahat, an enlightened one, is the biggest loser. So you're all losers coming here. And the bigger loser you are, the closer you are to being fully enlightened. So if somebody comes up to you and says, you Buddhists are losers. Wow, you're wise. That's very profound. And that's very true. We are losers. Isn't it nicer to lose things than gain things? So, sometimes people think they're enlightened. And they're not. So that's one of the problems there. Sometimes people come up to me and they say, I've got this jhana. It's a jhana, isn't it? I say, no. So they go to another monk who says it is. Sometimes they say, I'm a stream winner, aren't I, Jambam? I said, no way. I said, but this other monk said I was. Well, go to him. Because that's people who want to have attainments. Remember, all of these, so stream winner, once return, and non-return, arahat, they're all states of loss, not of gain. States of disappearing, vanishing. The more you grow on that path, the less ego is there. So the less chance is there of you saying or anything. Anyone says they're an arahat, fully enlightened. Look at me, I'm an arahat. See, I'm so proud of being an arahat. That is a dead ringer, clear sign that they ain't. So the real arahats, they disappear. You don't know who they are. They could be sitting right next to you. So anyway, so forget about all that. Okay, here we go again. Can you please tell how an arahat pays the good and bad actions of the past so she will not be born again? You don't need to pay back the actions of the past. I remember I used to play Monopoly as a kid. And my best card was a get out of jail free card. That's what you get when you become a stream winner. You get the get out of hell free card. So you don't need to go to the lower realms anymore. That's even just a stream winner, let alone an arahat. Why is that? Because you can let go of the past. And that is, I tell a lot of people, I have fun going to psychology conferences because, you know, Buddhism and psychology is just very close together. And psychologists, therapists, they realize Buddhism has a lot to teach them. It's such very popular. You know, if you're going to have a psychology conference, you usually get a Buddhist monk in there or a Buddhist nun. And, you know, we teach the psychologists what to do. And so I've been telling a lot of psychologists, I say, you don't have to dig up the past and work it all through. You can let the whole lot go in one go. And that's very radical psychology. But my God, it's true. Because that's what you do when you have like stream winning experiences. The whole lot of your past bad karma, You totally let it go. In one shot. You don't have to keep thinking about it. It's just like you've got this great big backpack on you of your past. You just take it off and put it in the bin. Bye-bye, past karma. You're free. So why do people think they have to keep punishing themselves because of what they've done in the past? It's because of the sense of self which you have. This idea of this continual me, I'm the same now as I was yesterday, as I was before. You're totally different. If you can only realize that, you can actually let go, not philosophically, but spiritually, emotionally, 100% fully. You weren't the same person as when you were a kid. So why do you have to punish yourself for what you did many years ago? You can forgive and let go. So no more lower realms left to you. No more bad karma. It's all taken away. One stroke. That's why in Buddhism, in Pali, they call it ahosi karma. Karma that was, which can't ripen anymore. It's absolutely brilliant to know that can be done. Because you've got so much bad karma. Oh, it's heaps of it. Think how many lifetimes you've lived. How many bad things have you done in this life, which you haven't paid off? Now multiply that by all the other lives you've lived. Oh, you've got heaps of stuff. So the only way to overcome it is just to let it all go. Bye-bye, past. Bye-bye, me. Bye-bye, bad karma. That's the way we do it. Yeah. Moggallana, he wasn't suffering, but there was the things with a really, really heavy karma, that some of that keeps coming back to you when you're an arahat, but that's only a tiny bit. The most of it doesn't come back. The good example is Angulimala, serial killer. That's a huge amount of bad karma. He only got a tiny bit back. It's nowhere near sort of the stuff which he should receive. The most of it is because it's the mental guilt. Why do you feel guilty? The whole idea of guilt is a very wonderful thing to contemplate. And you think, why should I feel guilty about what I did? I was trying my best, I made a mistake. That's all it is, it's just a mistake. So you learn from it and move on. You don't need to keep punishing yourself for what you did in the past. It doesn't make any sense to me. Does that really help you if you punish yourself? Not at all. So you acknowledge what you've done, learn from it, move on. No punishment, no guilt. Isn't that beautiful? I think so anyway. Oh, no, we've got too many questions here, so I have to just do these questions. And if any comments, write on a piece of paper for tomorrow night. I thoroughly enjoy your delightful talks and profound jokes. Shouldn't it be profound talks and delightful jokes? Anyway, never mind. It shows how sharp your mind is, as well as how creative and astute you are. That's really nice, isn't it? Right? These are the sort of questions I like. Does your creativity come from your mind? I've always associated... Does your creativity come from your mind? I've always associated my creativity with sexuality and sense desires. Are you saying that's where my creativity comes from? Thank you very much. Many artists also tell me that expressing their creativity feels erotic. If you're only into your desires, where does your inspiration flow from? Jeepers. You know where a lot of creativity comes from? Being playful. Not being erotic or sexual, just being playful. And what is actually playful? It means just allowing the mind just to go into different areas. And not being afraid if you make mistakes. Because that's one of the things when you tell a joke. Sometimes you tell a joke and it just doesn't work and people just don't understand it. But you still tell it anyway. And just what that means is that you are not afraid of what other people think of you. So you're willing to take risks. which is what creativity is all about. Taking risks, doing things differently, living on the wild side. That's what I do as a monk, living on the wild side. And that it's really weird a monk saying that, isn't it? But then when you're playful, that's where you get into creativity. And the other thing is, you don't think too much. So often it's happened, I've been giving a talk, you don't plan any talks, I don't know what I'm going to say next, you just, you know, run with things. And sometimes it's true, I've been giving talks and the words have come out and said, my goodness, where did that one come from? That's really inspiring. Did I say that? I don't know where it came from. But you just allow it to come out. And that means you've got no fear, you're not worried what people think about you, and you just allow creativity to happen. Because usually you find when you're afraid, you tend to repeat things. You're just being safe. But when you're creative, you just go in places you've never been before. You're willing to take that risk. And in order to become enlightened, to see the Dhamma, you've got to go to places you've never been before. You too have to take risks to become enlightened. Willing to see things which you've never seen before. To go, what did it say in Star Trek? To boldly go where no one has been before or something. We have the same saying in Buddhism, in the monastery. Not to boldly go, to boldly go. Where no monk has ever been before. So, you know, we take risks. This is what's going to happen in your meditation. You're going to be meditating there, and you have experiences you've never had before. Weird experiences, strange experiences. You're taking a risk when you go to uncharted territory of the mind. That's why sometimes it's scary meditating. But look, it's worth it. If you're playful, willing to take risks, you'll go to those deep stages of meditation. Even though everything starts to disappear and all that you can recognize vanishes, you go to incredibly weird and strange states of mind. You're willing to do that. You're willing to take the risks. You're willing to lose everything for the sake of truth. That type of courage is the same which you need for creativity. The nice thing though, if you've ever been creative, it's great fun, it's inspiring, it's joyful, it is playful. And the same way with the mind. If you're willing to take those risks, it's playful. And it's fun. And you go to incredible, beautiful states of mind. And then my job is to say, take those risks, you're perfectly safe. You don't go crazy. You just get enlightened, that's all. Anyway, Ajahn, what's the significance of a stupa? Like the two charcoal colored ones between the dining and meditation halls. I was told that I've got to read this out. I was told they're just phallic symbols. Just curious about their place in Buddhism. Thanks. Okay, I'm curious about your state of mind. Okay, those stupas, they are started off with funeral mounds. So whenever they buried anybody, they usually cremated them, they poured their ashes, and they just put a heap of earth on top of the ashes. And they just put an umbrella on top, because an umbrella was a symbol of respect. Only a few people had umbrellas. And a mound with an umbrella became a bigger mound with a spire. And if you actually see some of the stupas, say in Burma, they've got, it is like a ceremonial umbrella at the very, very top. And that's where it came from. And many, many years later, the stupas developed into all sorts of weird and strange designs. And, have to be this way, have to be that way. All it was just a mound of earth with an umbrella at the top. So that's all you really need to make a stupa. It's a mound of sand just next to the teacher's cottage. Put an umbrella on the top and you've got a stupa. Unfortunately, though, over the centuries, there's lots of traditions and lots of myths have actually come with stupas. And so now there's many ceremonies to be done, but I don't really like those ceremonies and just all of those superstitions which are not from the original time of the Buddha. However, they're there, but those are the stupas. And what happened is when I went to Indonesia once, they wanted to offer something for this jhana grove. It's like it's a symbol of Buddhism, having those stupas. And so around the area of Borobudur, there was a number of people who would make these and ship them overseas, and so two of them were offered. And if you want to know the tradition of the stupa, of that particular type of stupa, of Borobudur, you notice that inside is a Buddha statue. And the tradition is that if you can get onto the platform there, and if you can reach inside, and if you can touch the Buddha statue inside, that means that you will find true love. So if I see any of you trying that tomorrow, I'll say, what the heck are you doing, especially if you're married? That's a tradition anyway. So you see all these young people up there, you know, in Borobudur in Java, climbing up there and just trying to touch a Buddha, you know, just nothing to do with Dhamma, but just trying to find true love. So it's just, it's a nice symbol of Buddhism, and it's quite attractive, it's quite a beautiful design. So that's the nicest thing about it. It gives this place like a bit of a Buddhist symbolism, and it's a nice ornament for the gardens. It looks good. Otherwise, this retreat center would look too, it's too practical without any sort of inspirational buildings. So those are inspirational buildings. Thanks for being a spiritual leader that walks the talk and not afraid to speak up. Would you allow Bodhinyana to evolve into a vegetarian monastery, such as Santi Monastery, provided that this is the majority decision by the Sangha or supporting community? Would you like to see that happen or not? Had the Buddha lived today, would he have thought it wise, kind, gentle, compassionate? Choose one, to silently consent and thereby passively encourage the industrial mass murder of innocent animals. Wow, that makes me feel like sort of serial killer. Bodhinyana isn't just content with any dana, i.e. tobacco, cake or chocolate with a bit of alcohol is a no-no, and the rotten frog eating conditions of time doesn't reflect today's WA birth. We try our best. I tried to be a vegetarian here in Bodhinyana some years ago. And what changed me, I just gave up. What changed me was when I went to a Laotian person's house. They were doing an offering to the monks. And it was almost like I thought it was just a teaching to me. Because we had rice. And everything else was a different type of meat. Every different type of meat you could imagine was served. But nothing else. No vegetables, not one piece of fruit. It's just all different types of meat. And I sort of ate the rice, but I sort of hid what I was eating so they wouldn't see that all I was eating was rice. Otherwise they got very, very upset. Cause they were very, very kind people. And I realized that my stomach does not belong to me. Sometimes it's just too hard to arrange it. So I've just given up. But if anyone else wants to do it, that's fine. If our bodies don't go with us onto the next life and our soul doesn't either, what does go with us? Our mind? Your karma goes with you into your next life. So make sure that you get some good karma. Although, there's an old story of this very, very, very wealthy man. So he went up to his priest and said, is it really true you can't take anything with you when you die? And he said, yeah, of course it's true. He said, look, I'm a very, very, very wealthy man. I will give $5 million to your church if you let me take something with me to heaven. Now, $5 million is a lot of money. So the priest said, well, let me pray to God and see if I get any answer. Because, you know, he wanted the $5 million. So he prayed to God, and he got this inspiration. God said, okay, just this once. Because, you know, you needed the $5 million for your church, but he could only take one suitcase. So the priest came back and said, this is what I've heard. I've been praying. I got this from God's own mouth. This is the first exception ever. You can take one suitcase if you write out the check for 5 million. So the priest got his 5 million and the rich person had one suitcase. I thought, what should I take? Should I take US dollars, Australian dollars? That's pretty good. No. The best commodity to invest in today is gold. So he filled a suitcase with gold bars, solid gold. And then he died. And after he died, he appeared at heaven with his suitcase. And as soon as he tried to get into the gate with his suitcase, the angel stopped and said, you can't bring anything in here. That's the rule. You can't bring it with you. And he said, well, I got special permission from God himself. So the angel sort of SMS God, and the message came back. Yes, this guy has got special permission, the only one. And so the angel said, well, I've never seen this before, but the boss says you're okay. You can take it in, but what is in the bag anyway? Just let me know. And he opened the bag. And the angel was so surprised. I mean, you've brought paving bricks up to heaven. Because, okay, someone's got it. See what I was saying? Sometimes you tell a joke and it doesn't get understood. In heaven, they're supposed to be paved with gold. There's gold everywhere. Okay, you get it now. Oh, gee, I'm giving up. So not only karma goes with you to your next life, but your bad sense of humour goes with you. Anyway, it's your stream of consciousness, your karma especially. Ajahn, if the future is uncertain, what about the prediction of the future Maitreya Buddha? Who knows? Maybe it's not going to happen. Maybe it is. Who knows? We don't know when anyway. So I don't know what's going to happen next. So the future is so uncertain, who knows what the next question is going to be. As I grow older, I feel the pain and suffering from those around me and humanity in general. It gets too much for me. I can no longer watch TV on the news. Is this compassion, pity, or what? I don't know what. I don't want it. How do I overcome it, please? I can't even handle my own pain and suffering. Thank you so much for being you. Okay, at least you can handle my pain and suffering for saying thank you to me. But you're growing older, you feel the pain and suffering from those around you. Okay, yeah, there is a lot of pain and suffering for those around you. But can you also feel the happiness from those around you as well? There's a lot of joy out there as well. And sometimes we just focus on one thing. And when we focus on one thing, we just see other people's pain. And if you see other people's pain, other people see it as well. I remember once I stepped on a nail in Thailand. I was on arms round, barefoot. And this nail went a couple of inches into my foot. And I saw it, and it didn't hurt. But a monk with me looked at that, oh my God! And once he said that, it hurt like hell. A stupid man shouldn't have said that. So, because I hadn't seen my pain and suffering, but when he did, then I saw it. Do you get the message there? If you see other people's pain and suffering, oh, that must really hurt. Having babies and whatever else you have, that must really hurt. And when you go, oh yeah, it does. But if you say, it's not hurt, it's just like, going to the toilet, having a big poo. That's what someone said, the biggest dump in your life. Then maybe it doesn't hurt. So the point is, whatever you look at in another person, they see in themselves. So that's why when I used to go to prisons to teach the people up in Kada and other places, I would never look at the bad things they'd done. I never look at their pain. I look at their happiness, their goodness, their joy. And they saw it in themselves. And that was the whole trick, to get them to see their goodness, their happiness. And I call that these days, you water the flowers or you water the weeds. Which one do you want to water? Which one do you want to pay attention to? If you pay attention to the suffering in the world, the suffering gets more. If you pay attention to the goodness in the world, the joy in the world, the joy gets more. You've got a choice. It's not being in denial. It's actually, if you notice the faults get worse. You make them grow. You're creating the world. If you notice the beauty and the joy and celebrate that, the beauty and the joy grows. So, as you get older, get wiser. And just notice the beauty in other people. And then they'll see it themselves. And you're creating much more happiness in the world. Again, that's why when you come to the interviews with your stupid comments, I say, very good! You know, what am I doing? I'm seeing the beauty in you, the good in you, and just that what's happening, that you're seeing the good in yourself. And that really works. So as I grow older, I feel the joy and happiness from those around me. And when I feel it, you feel it too. Yesterday you spoke about waiting on the present moment instead of waiting in expectation or anticipation of the future. This was in the context of meditation. In your daily life as abbot and globe-trotting Dharma teacher, how do you plan projects without putting expectations on yourself? Results, outcomes, or the people you work with? It's very easy. You delegate. Get some other people to do it for you. I'm not joking that you do go to overseas, and when you get picked up there, you just ask them, what am I doing today? And they tell me, and this is no joke, I don't look at the schedule. They say, oh, you're going to give a talk, you know, in an hour. Okay, so I go and give a talk. And then what do I do next? They could go interview. Okay. It's much nicer that way, because if you see, if I saw all the things they get me to do, I can't do that. It's impossible. Too much. You just do one thing at a time, and it's very easy. So I let other people do all that planning for me, and that's why I love going overseas, because I don't have to do anything. I don't plan. And they pick me up. You know, they put me on a seat and say, talk, so I talk. They say, get down now, so I get down. They say, eat, so I eat. It's much nicer, though. I don't make any decisions. They just do it for me. Say, sleep? Okay, sleep. And they get up in the morning. Now you go to the airport. Thank you very much. So it's great. That's also why I like going on the aircraft. As I said, you can't do anything there. You're just sitting there meditating, having a nice time, doing nothing. Oh, it's great. And the nicest thing about being in the aircraft, no one can come up to you and ask you any questions. That's what I thought. And this happened, I think, just the end of last year, November. I was giving some talks in Malacca. And a few other talks somewhere. And, you know, one of these really heavy schedules all day talking to people. I think they're supposed to have some free time, but there was a celebrity wedding and there was a novice ordination. So they got me to do all this extra stuff as well. So I didn't have any rest. And at the end of the session, I was going to the KLIA airport. So they drove me from Malacca. And it always happens if someone's got you in the car, they think, this is a wonderful opportunity to have one-on-one interview. And I can't get out. I can't sort of say I've got to go to the toilet. I'm stuck there. So they talk to me all the way to the airport. And when eventually, you know, you get on board, you think, at last, now I can have some peace and meditate. No one's going to ask me any question. But I was sitting there on the aircraft, window seat, so away from everybody. And then this woman came past. Ajahn Brahm, you're Ajahn Brahm. You know, I always wanted to have a chat with you. But there was a man sitting, I'm sorry, but you know, this man is sitting next to me, so I'm very sorry. And so she looked at the man, would you mind changing seats? And I must admit, a great deal of aversion came up. Especially when he said, yeah, okay. So this woman had me trapped. She was talking about her marital problems, her relationship problems. It wasn't funny, Cheng, it was suffering. I mean, you can't escape, so just forget it. So you did whatever you could. So that was actually my life. But most of the time you're in that aircraft and people can't talk to you, which is great. That's why I like it. So you don't plan anything, it just happens. And if you try and plan things, that's when it all goes wrong. That's what I plan. I can have a nice quiet time in the aircraft. And as soon as I plan it, there's some lady who knows me, comes and sits next to me. So it's much nicer when you don't plan anything. So that's actually true. There's a lot of things I don't plan. Sometimes I think I should, because that, for example, that teacher's cottage up there, I should really get the roof on someday. But you know, I've got to get around and plan that soon. But anyway, one day it'll come on. Would you please explain how to be aware of the breath without attending to the body, without attending to the bodily sensations created by its movement, since breath on its own is intangible and only perceptible through its contact with object? Yeah, but you feel the sensations, but you don't locate the sensations anywhere in your body. You just know the breath. And the way I do that, because I'm fortunate to teach meditation to people who've never meditated before. So they came up to me, teach me how to meditate. So I say, close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, and at the end of the 3rd breath, open your eyes. And everybody does that. But then I say, after they've opened their eyes, say, how did you know you were breathing in or breathing out? And people who never meditated before, they don't watch the breath at the tip of the nose, they don't watch the breath anywhere, but they still know, yes, I was breathing in, yes, I was breathing out. Great. Now that's how you meditate. On the breath. You just know you're breathing in. You know you're breathing out. But the perception of where that's happening is not there at all. And if you were taught meditation like that from the very beginning, you'd save a lot of problems. Because if you watch the breath at the tip of the nose, so many people get headaches. When I first went to Malaysia, they called it samadhi headache. And that really worried me, because I never heard that before at all. It's not in the suttas, in the time of the Buddha, no one has a samadhi headache. But then somebody told me why that is happening. And I've done this demonstration before, but I have to take off my glasses to do it. Usually when people meditate and watch the breath, they've got their eyes closed. I'm going to keep my eyes open, but I'm going to still watch the breath at the tip of my nose to show you what you do. So when I start watching the breath at the tip of my nose, I go cross-eyed. Now usually you've got your eyes closed and you can't see that, but underneath your eyelids, actually that's what's happening. And imagine I did this for half an hour, I sort of get a headache. Because that's what happens. What you actually notice with your mind, your eyes go there as well. It's just a habit. Which is why many people, when they watch the breath at the tip of the nose, if you could peel their eyelids, they'll be going cross-eyed. That's where you get the headache from. So don't watch the breath anywhere. Just wherever the breath happens to be, that's where you watch. But you don't locate it on the body. And doing it that way means you're letting go of the awareness of the body very fast. So the body actually disappears much quicker. But if you watch the tip of the nose, if you watch the belly, you're still getting a lot of body awareness and the body doesn't disappear very quickly at all. So it's very good just to watch the breath, nowhere in particular, but you know the breath is going in, know it's going out, that's enough. Ajahn Brahm, do the Brahma Viharas practice at an ordinary level have a role in allowing things to be and naturalness in meditation practice and daily activity? The Brahma Viharas are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And of course they do. The loving kindness and the compassion, that's just being kind. And the equanimity is making peace. The mudita, the sympathetic joy, that's one of the most beautiful things in the whole world. When you sort of see someone sitting next to you and they're so peaceful and so happy. And you think, isn't it wonderful that someone is getting enlightened, even though it's not me? When you see someone take the last piece of bread in the morning and you think, oh wonderful, they're so happy with the last piece of bread. Or do you think, the pig, they've already got 6-7 pieces of bread and I've only got none at all. Don't they think of anybody else? No, have some sympathetic joy. So when other people are having a fun and being happy, you're happy too. So that's what sympathetic joy. That's actually free happiness, which people don't make use of. And it's given for free and we just don't take it. Someone else is happy, we can be happy with them. So jealousy, you know, ego and comparing, that stops you enjoying sympathetic joy. It's one of the great, they call Brahma Viharas. So they do have a role in allowing things to be natural in meditation. You're just kind and you're just equanimous. Just let things be. I am from the UK and I find Australia boring and sterile. Marvellous! That's why you can get into very deep meditation in Australia. If it's UK, it's too exciting. You know, if you're too exciting, it means that your just mind will go all over the place. You'll never find the Dhamma. You'll never find peace. So boring is cool. That's why in the northeast of Thailand, where all these great meditation masters came from, like Ajahn Chah, it's one of the most boring places in the world. It's flat. The soil is no good, so the trees aren't very nice. There's no mountains. You don't see great rivers or waterfalls. It's one of the most boring parts in the world, which is why tourists never go there. But it's a great place to meditate. Like this hall is boring. It's just a square. It's just a box. Yes, that's on purpose. It's sterile. That's why you get good meditation in here. So, I cannot adjust. I feel like my personality is like cardboard here. Help me, please. Cardboard is cool. It's recyclable. So your personality is recyclable. In other words, it's going to get reincarnated. So being cardboard is wonderful. I mean, what else would you like to be? You know, wood? If wood creates so much destruction to the environment, cutting down all those trees, plastic, do you want to have a plastic personality? What type of personality you want? Cardboard is beautiful. It's soft, recyclable, and great. So, you're going well. So, congratulations from leaving the UK and going to the boring, sterile. What does sterile mean? It means you can't have sex. You really are getting rid of a lot of suffering with sterility. You have all these babies and they're crying all the time and they're pooing in their pants. Is that really what life is all about? Gee, you're so lucky going to Australia. Boring, sterile and cardboard personalities. Yup. He said, let go of the body as soon as possible. How do you know when it's possible? Now it's possible. Anytime. Can you please tell us if lying such as white lies is okay? Lies don't have colours. Clothes have colours. Walls have colours. Flowers have colours. Lies haven't got any colours at all. So, all lies are bad. 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 So they're not white lies. They're bad lies, very bad lies, and extremely bad lies. When is it okay to lie? Is it best not to in any circumstances? Yeah, tell the truth. It's more fun. Regarding the chanting, healing, or for sick people, there is a research report about this. Paul Chang Paparit, the scientist, believes that alpha wave in brain may be changed after listening to the chanting and be linked to the healing process. What do you think? Actually, there was some research done in the United States. They had people chanting for people, and some of the people didn't know they were chanting for, some knew they were chanting for, and they wanted to, you know, they used a controlled group, a very, very large study, and they found that chanting didn't work at all. They found that. It was a great big study done recently. So all those monks and nuns who make their living in by chanting, and all of you who get the monks and nuns to go to your new house to chant for you, does it work? I don't know, because if it doesn't work, they never invite me back. That's why there was this famous story of mine. There was a young lady, I think she was from Malaysia, and it was just before her exams at university. She came to the monks and asked for some chanting. We'd always chant anyway, just to give a bit of a morale boost. But then she never came back again into the temple. We heard from her friends that she was criticizing the monks of Bodhinyana. We can't chant properly, she kept on saying, because she failed. And she blamed us. It's monk's fault that I failed my exams because we can't chant properly. Thank you very much. So, The point was that she was just never went to lectures, never did her homework, was just partying all the time. So she thought the monks, they would actually look after the, you know, that part for them. So Charlie, give you a morale boost, give you an uplift. But don't think it's going to do more than that. I don't know, maybe it does. Because I got very concerned about a month ago. I was reading the newspaper, I read the Western Australian to find out what's happening in the world. It was on the weekend, the Saturday paper. And I read in that paper that there was the most successful lottery store in the whole of Western Australia. They had an article about it. You know, that had won more first prizes than anywhere else in the whole of Australia. And as soon as I looked at the photo, my heart sank. Because about 2 or 3 years ago, one of our disciples, you know, Heng Yi, for those who know Heng Yi, he said his friend was opening up a shop. Could I come and bless it? I didn't know what shop it was, but he took me into one of these shopping centres. And it was a lottery shop, and it was that one. It's the only lottery shop I blessed, ever. And I shouldn't have done that. You're not supposed to get involved in lotteries. But I did that one, and it's the most famous, most successful lottery shop in the whole of Western Australia. And if you're thinking I'm going to tell you where it is, no way. So maybe it does work. Why, when the Buddha gave a teaching, some became stream entrants and some arahats? What prevented those who got stream entry from arahat? Because stupidity all the time. So, like, some of the talks which the Buddha gave and all these people became enlightened, you can actually read those talks, the very same talks, you can read it. And you hear this talk and 1,000 people became enlightened, you read it, not you. Oh dear, why is that? Because in those times it wasn't just listening to the talk, it was also doing the meditation, being prepared. So by meditating you're making all the preparations. Serious point, to become enlightened, you need two things. You need the depth in meditation and you need the teachings as well. I call it the gunpowder and the match. If you had lots and lots of teachings, you've really heard a lot of talks, you know a lot about Buddhism, you've got heaps and heaps of gunpowder, but that won't make an explosion. You need a match. And the match is the jhanas. You get a jhana, the match, and you have understanding the Buddha's teachings. That combination is where enlightenment comes from. That's why I really encourage people to really get into deep meditation. A poem for a dear monk. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you are so calm, like a misty farm. Your wisdom is like that of a 500-year-old man. I feel like that some days. Not saying that you are old, but I am a fan. Can you be so kind to live till then, though? You are a dear monk with a heart the size of your belly. No, a that's what it says. With a heart the size of King Kong. You're talking to me about a gorilla. You are a dear monk with a heart the size of King Kong, which is why you deserve this song. May you have eternal peace, and that thank you for the keys to open the door of our hearts. Okay, what do you reckon? Now that's a poem. Actually, I should have said it much better, so someone's been very kind. Thank you very much. Dear Ajahn, not only are you a very wise monk, but also you are a very clever CEO. You hired a fantastic retreat manager and coordinator who is full of energy, and despite doing 101 things at the same time, Bianca still manages to smile every time you approach her. Well done. Where is she? She's gone home. Ah, okay, I'll have to read this question out again tomorrow for her. Yeah, but she's very nice. Everybody does this for free. You know, imagine this is her holiday. She's a relief teacher, so she spends most of the time teaching. So this is her holiday time. So coming here, cooking for you, looking after you. And just doing this because if you do things for others, you get a lot of happiness. So if she's smiling, The secret of her smile is selflessness, selfless service for others. So, when the retreat is finished, see what you can do to serve a community in Singapore like the Buddhist Fellowship, serve in Malaysia like the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, here in Perth, you know, the Buddhist Society of West Australia. See what you can contribute. I don't mean writing checks. I mean just going out there and seeing if you can serve on the committee, see if you can do some gardening. See if you can come and do some work here when, you know, you've got a day off. There's always stuff to do around the place. Contribute. Because, you know, we don't look for money here. We look for beautiful hearts. How does one reconcile the practice of mindfulness in silence with the practicalities and task-oriented nature of lay life? If a doctor watches his or her patient silently and do nothing, most of them will probably die. That should be very good for the health system because there's too many people, too many patients, so getting rid of a few will probably ease out the bed shortage in hospitals. Makes a lot of sense to me, doesn't it? What's wrong with dying anyway? What is the main purpose of a doctor? It is not to cure the patients. The main duty of a doctor is to care for them. So some doctors or nurses think their main job is to prevent death. And that is a stupid idea. The main job of a doctor is to care for the patients. Because you can't always prevent death. But you can always care for somebody. And that way, if the doctor is always caring for people, even if they die, it's a great success. They've cared for the person. But if they always try and prevent death, not only will they fail, but they won't give care. Sometimes preventing death is more important than caring. And that's why the experiences in some hospitals are very unpleasant. So if a doctor realizes their main job is to care, not to prevent death, but to care for the patient, then the experience people have in hospitals will be much better. And actually the amounts of recovery will be much better. And even if you do die, you die knowing you've been cared for. Isn't that beautiful? So, that's how we reconcile the practice of mindfulness. It's not mindfulness, it's also kindness. With the practice and the task-oriented nature of lay life. If a doctor watches his or her patients kindly, then most of them will probably survive, and if they do die, they die beautifully. I realize there are clear black and white cases, but many fall within a grey area of life. Many thanks for your answer. A Zen master and his student were walking in silence through a forest. Here we go. A Zen master and his student were walking in silence through a forest. When they came to a huge oak tree, the student said, "Wow!" The Zen master punched his student in the stomach. I'm glad you're not in a Zen monastery. When the student asked why, the master said, "Zen masters are allowed to do stuff for no reason." Okay. And the students are allowed to go to their lawyer and sue that Zen master. So you've got to be very careful as a Zen master these days. Because if you hit someone with a stick, they're liable to hit you back. And if you punch someone, they're liable to actually to get their lawyer. So be very careful. Actually, we did have that once in our city centre. We invited like a Zen master during our range retreat because the monks were over here meditating. So a Zen master came. He had one of these sticks. And he actually whacked a couple of people in our temple. When I heard that, I was terrified that someone would sue us and we'd lose all our money. You've got to be very careful. You can't assault people like that. So be very careful. So anyway, the Zen master, that's actually too profound for me. So anyway. I would like to express my opinion about chanting. Here we go. A study concludes that 60 to 80% of what we hear will be forgotten. How much of that do you remember? Another study suggests that one of the most effective ways to learn is by recalling. Chanting is just that, a recall technique. Given that the Buddha was not aware of these studies, I thought it was a clever idea to use this technique for his teachings. So chanting should be use more, not less, but must be in a language we all understand. Yeah, I agree with that. So that's why we do, this is what should be done. So you can understand that chant. So it's great actually having that chanting. It's true that you chant it many, many times, you remember it. Ajahn, like, make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's what we should chant in the morning. Okay? Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Until you remember it. Ajahn, as mentioned in this morning's talk, there is actually a Buddha Air that operates in Nepal, Kathmandu. The flights take off for sightseeing tours of Mount Everest in the region. At the end of the flight, the airline will present a certificate to say you travel with Buddha Air, but no flight attendants are employed. Yeah, that's why you don't get enlightened. It's the wrong Buddha Air. How to overcome the fear of big spiders and scorpions, especially if they come into the room. I can't sleep very well at night thinking they might crawl up my bed when I'm sleeping and got bitten by the poisonous sting. Thanks. Isn't it great to have a bit of excitement in the Buddhist center? Somebody said this place is boring and they want to go back to the UK. UK doesn't have venomous spiders. So this is really alive. That spider may come in. And it's true in Thailand. There's heaps and heaps of venomous things. And I remember many times in the hot season, you know, you'd lie down for a rest. You just have your lower robe, but your front robe, or the, you know, from your waist up, it was bare. And the tarantulas would fall on the roof on you. They fall on your chest. And say, right off. Many times, you know, big tarantulas, and bigger than my hand, these big ones. It was quite nice. They were sort of tickly. You just get used to these after a while. They never bite you. Look, you know, you only come to this forest maybe 9 days a year, only a couple of years. You know, people like Daniel live here. I live over the road for 27 years. There's all sorts of bugs and stuff over there. They don't worry about them. You won't get bitten unless you've got bad karma. Unless you've been breaking your precepts and doing naughty things in this retreat. So if you be breaking the rules, there's a karma spider coming. No, they won't do anything. You're perfectly safe in this place. So, I mean, these are just beings who are just living their life. And the animals over here in Australia, they're not really aggressive. I've seen so many snakes, you know, over the road, and they're really bad snakes over there. They can really sort of, they bite you in big trouble. But nothing's ever bitten any monk over there or any visitor. So everything is very, very benign here. Because you're kind to the animals are kind to you. So just have some metta. And those spiders and scorpions, they won't ever harm you. So do some metta. The poor spider. Not doing anything. And anyway, you remember that story of the suicidal spider? Don't know that story? But no one likes spiders. So, where can we say this? Okay, in a little place to the northeast of Perth, the spider tried to make a web in somebody's house. He'd only just be born, and this was the spider's first house. And so he put so much care into building his web. It was a beautiful web, well crafted. And having worked such a long time building his web, he sat in the middle waiting for lunch. And he'd only been sitting in there maybe 5 minutes and no fly had come in yet. But the owner of the house came in and saw a spider web in the corner. And took the broom and smashed the spider web to bits. And the spider had to run for his life. He only just escaped. And he hadn't had anything to eat. And he put so much care into that house. And it was destroyed almost immediately. So of course he ran away to the next house. And he built another web in a corner of a room. And it was just finished. The owner saw it. Smash! And it happened to another house, and another house, out about 5 or 6 webs, all destroyed with nothing to eat, that poor spider got depressed. What's the point? No one likes spiders. They hate us. All I'm trying to do is build a home for myself. I'm not harming anybody. I'm catching all these flies for them. And I haven't eaten not one meal. And he got so depressed, he started crying. And he started, what's the point? If I go and build just another web, it'll just get destroyed. And I'm so hungry. I'm so alone. And he soon became suicidal. He was a suicidal spider. He saw some people walking down the road and he tried to get underneath their shoes. But he always got the place between the heel and the sole. He never got squashed. He couldn't even commit suicide. And he got even more depressed. He crawled over the road to try and get squashed by a truck, but always managed to get between the wheels, never under them. And he was just so depressed. And there he was, crying, really miserable, the most miserable spider that ever lived. When he saw a happy spider, there was this big, fat, jolly, happy spider, sunning himself in the morning sun like you did this morning. I saw many of you. And the suicidal spider said, this is really weird. Why is this guy so fat and so happy? And so the happy spider saw the suicidal spider. Why are you so sad and depressed? People always want to tell their tale of woe. This is what happened to me. The first house smashed to bits. Second the same. I had to run for my life. I haven't eaten since I was born. I'm hungry and so alone. And the big fat spider said, oh, that's so sad. Why don't you come and stay with me? Look, I've got plenty to eat. And the suicidal spider said, how can that be? In your home, didn't people try and destroy your web? Said, no, not at all. I've had one web ever since I began. I catch plenty of flies and other stuff in there, and there's plenty to eat. Come on, you can live with me. Where can that be? Said suicidal spider, where no one ever disturbs you. Oh, said the fat spider, I built my web in the donation box of Dhammasara Monastery. No one ever disturbs you there. Is that true? Kamanti? You who knows, there may be a fat spider in there. So yeah, that's the story of the spider. Very old joke, but it's a good one. I use that when I go to other temples, even churches, to get some money for them. Dear Ajahn, in the modern world they say doing Sudoku or crossword is the best as an exercise of mind. In Buddhist teachings, is it to bring the mind to still? What is your explanation, please? The best way to get energy is to keep the mind absolutely still. But if you want to do it as a bit of exercise, I do Sudokus every now and again. It's a bit of good fun. But I should actually say that when you're on retreat, when you're meditating, it's also good to have playtime sometimes. Playtime is when you tell your mind, okay, you don't need to meditate now. Just take a bit of time off. Because you know what it's like at school? You always have playtime in the morning, in the afternoon, recess, because if you keep trying, soon your mind gets very dull and dispirited. So sometimes a bit of playtime. Take a cup of tea. I've seen you doing playtime. A cup of tea and just watching the sun. That's actually not doing anything, just enjoying. So I noticed that because when I was growing up in the northeast of Thailand, some of the monks there were very strict. I remember going to perhaps the strictest monastery, Ajahn Maha Bua's monastery. And when it became tea time, now this great strict monk would come and sit with the monks and he would tell jokes. And that was a part of that monk which hardly anybody saw, because he'd only tell it when the monks were around and no lay people. And he said, no, this is not meditation time, this is just no fellowship, just relax. Because you work hard otherwise. So there is a time for playtime. And that means you get a bit of happiness and joy, and then you go and meditate. A Buddhist joke. Here we go. There's nothing to it. And that's profound. There's nothing to it. Anyway, but seriously, why did the Buddhist coroner get the sack? He kept recording birth as the cause of death. Shame he ripped off from the internet, yeah. Because what's the cause of death? Because you're born. So that's why the coroner... I didn't write that. It's not my fault. You didn't write what do you think about Mayan calendar? Do you believe in global awareness revolution? Maybe we should organize meditation retreat around 12th of the 12th, 2012. Perhaps people can easily get enlightenment. No, that Mayan calendar, no one really knows what the Mayan calendar was, because all the Mayans are dead. So much for there. They died before 2012. So the whole civilization got wiped out, and no one knows why. All sorts of theories. So anyway, what do I think about the Mayan calendar? It's out of date. Is it true that organ donation is not favored according to Tibetan Buddhism? What does Theravada teaching say? Can you briefly explain, please? I know that St. George's Cathedral got a good organ donation. It's true. Because I've been there a couple of times and their organ was donated not so long ago. Now, okay, the organ donation, donating your blood, donating your liver or your heart or whatever. The Tibetan tradition, seriously, they say that you shouldn't move the body for actually, some say for quite a few hours, sometimes for a few days, depending on what tradition you come from, after death, which means organ donation becomes almost impossible. I remember reading Lama Zopi, he said, no, compassion is more important. Move the body, take the organs. But a lot of Tibetan Buddhists say, no, you can't do that. Now, that tradition of the mind being connected to the body after death, that came from Vasubandhu, that was about 1,500 years ago. It's not original to Buddhism. And that's why you can actually question that. That's not true. So you can burn a body, even in the old time of the suttas, as soon as a person was dead, they would just burn the body straight away. They'd do whatever they needed to do. They didn't wait around at all in the time of the Buddha. So that's a little bit of a myth. I argue with the Tibetans about this. Original Buddhism didn't have that. As soon as you die, the stream of consciousness leaves the body and you can't feel what's going on. There's a lot of evidence to support that. So that as soon as you're dead, they can take whatever they want out and you won't feel a thing. And it will not disturb the process of your death because you'll be looking there knowing that, you know, your heart or organs, whatever is useful, is going to a good cause. So it won't disturb the death process, it'll inspire you. You're making dana at the very end. It's a good karma. It's a good mind state, which is what we're supposed to do when we're dead. So it's a great thing to do. All Buddhists should do that. Tibetan, Theravada, whatever. The compassionate mind at that time, seeing what's going on, you won't feel any pain, it won't disturb the process of the death, it will actually enhance your rebirth. All the time, 100%. So please be an organ donor. I am an organ donor, I've got my card. I want to donate my brain. If I donate my brain, will a recipient still tell bad jokes? What do you reckon? Because people have done that, you know, they've had these heart transplants. We had a book on heart transplants a few years ago down in the monastery, and you got some very weird stories. Because the first story was of this girl, and she had a heart transplant. And when she got back home after the operation, she started having nightmares. Nightmares about being murdered. And the mother was so concerned, she told the doctor, and the doctor said, this is a very traumatic operation. And it's just, you know, the trauma of the operation creating these nightmares. Don't think about it. Don't worry about it. But the mother, the nightmares were consistent with a lot of detail. So the mother actually went to the local police station and described what the daughter was dreaming of. And the police were very interested because there was an unsolved murder which fit the description of the girl. And so the police checked where the heart came from. The police could do that, the family couldn't. And it was from this murder victim. This little girl had got the heart of a woman who'd been murdered. And in her dreams, she could recall the situation, the circumstances. On the basis of this little girl's dreams, which the police recorded, they arrested the suspect and he confessed. It's an amazing story. The old heart in the new body told her who killed the owner of the old heart. And the other story, many men, especially elderly men, are interested in this story because it was an elderly lady, maybe in her late 50s. She had a heart transplant, but her heart came from a murdered prostitute. And so when she recovered from her operation, her husband said she became very frisky. That's what he said. And he was very, very happy with his new wife when she came back with the heart of a prostitute. I think you can understand what he's talking about. She was just more interested in sex and other stuff. Because there was something from the old heart actually, you know, came into the new body. So I remember telling that story in Nolamara one night, and people were sort of saying, where can we get our wife a new heart? You know what men are like, you've been married to them. So anyway, there was actually something actually came in from them. It's interesting to find out why. But it usually after just a few months, just the old memories and the old traits just disappeared. And you just became your old self again. You didn't take on the personality of the owner of the heart, the new heart. Your old personality came back again. Why that happens, who knows? So organ donation, actually, you do get a bit from the owner of the old organ, which is fascinating. Can meditation be considered a physical act whereby a person learns to control the mind to attain higher stages of mind? What happens to a murderer who will do the same meditation behind bars in a prison? A man in prison has more freedom of mind. It's a physical act by which a person learns to control the mind. You try and control the mind, it'll go out of control. So it is a type of control of mind in the sense that you really want the mind to become peaceful, wise and happy, but you don't do that through this controlling. The controlling works in the opposite direction. By letting go, by being kind, then the purpose for which you wanted to exercise control is achieved. You're peaceful, you're happy, you're smart. So it's actually how to reach that goal. Not through control, but through letting go, is why we train in meditation. What happens to a murderer who will do the same meditation? There's no such thing as a murderer. There's people who have murdered. There's no such thing as a murderer. There's much more to them than the crime. So there's no such thing as a murderer, just a person who's murdered. So that means they can't meditate because they're focusing on that part of them which didn't do the murder. Thank you very much for building this wonderful retreat center. We are so fortunate to be listening to the most beautiful Dharma and be feeling and experiencing freedom in the true sense. I think someone's been drinking too much coffee. No, it's very nice, you're inspired. You know what happens? This is true. When you get into the nice meditation, you feel very, very happy. You know, you feel so much gratitude. You know, not just to the teacher, to the place, you know, to Bianca, to everybody else, to Dania for caretaking, all the people who work here. You feel so much gratitude to everybody when you get inspired, even to the spiders. You feel so much gratitude for sharing their place with you. This morning talks made me feel that I'm no more judged while I'm here. May you and this monastery in Western Australia be the center for the whole world for peace and happiness. Should we move the UN here? United Nations in China Grove. It's the center for peace and happiness. And something needs to be done anyway. Really appreciate all the nice food. Now I have to do more walking meditation instead. Because you're getting fat. Now you understand why I put on weight. You know, it's just nice food. And one of the reasons it's nice food is because people put so much care Like today we had the Vietnamese community coming here. They don't need to come here. They haven't been told to come here. They don't get paid to come here. I know the food they give us is prepared with so much care and love. They actually put extra into what they're doing. I learned this when I first came here to Australia. Because you know, all these Thai women, Western women, Sri Lankan women would cook the meal for Ajahn Chakro and I. And sometimes their husbands would come as well. And they look at that food and they tell us, my wife never cooks like this for me. You know, they just get ordinary stuff, but we get the very best. You know what the wife would often say? Why don't you become a monk then? But it showed us they put extra love and care when they cook for us. So that's why the food you get is much better than any restaurant. Because of the amount of love. And they do it from their heart. They're not getting anything out of it. That's why you get such delicious food here. Because of the love and care which is put into it. And that's also why you get fat. But if you get fat, you have to be happy. Have you ever noticed in history, all the fat people are jolly people? You never see a miserable fat person. They're always jolly. I remember as a kid, I used to see Friar Tuck in Robin Hood. Now, he was really fat, but he was always having a great time, really joyful and happy. And it was a year or two ago, I found out the reason why. It was a scientific article, because they said, actually, when you laugh and when you're happy, your arteries actually expand. They get bigger. So if you're jolly, it actually sort of balances, you know, all of the extra fat and stuff which are in your arteries, you know, when you are, you know, you're fat and put on weight. It means, yeah, you've got more gunk in your arteries, but they're bigger, so it can actually take it. But if you are miserable and fat, it's a double whammy. Your arteries are smaller and there's more gunk trying to get through. And of course, that's where you get the heart attacks from. So it is like evolution, you know, the sort of weeding out of the fat, miserable ones. They die earlier. Because, you know, too narrow arteries, too much gunk. But the fat, happy ones, you can get away with it. Because, yeah, you get more gunk in your arteries than most people do, but the arteries are fatter to take it all. Because you're laughing more. So if you're overweight or putting on weight, you have to start laughing quickly. Otherwise, you're dead. That's science. According to Ajahn Brahm. And thanks who made a special effort to replace missing spoons, forks, bowls, plate after each meal. Dear Ajahn, what is ditti? Is observing auspicious time for weddings and special events a ditti? A ditti is like, ditti means view or opinion, but in Thai it always means wrong view. So if you have ditti in Thai, it means you have some wrong view. In other words, we're not seeing things clearly. And sometimes it means just like an attachment to a view, a superstitious view, like observing auspicious times for weddings. The most auspicious time for a wedding is never. I'm not romantic. No. Honestly, I haven't told that joke here. I think I told it at Armadale Group. About the fellow who was walking down the street. And he heard a sound, someone speaking to him, say, stop! So he stopped. And just right in front of him, a piece of masonry fell off a building. Right in front of him. If he hadn't heard that word stop, he'd have been killed. And he didn't know where that word came from. And he carried on walking a little bit further and round the corner. And again he said, stop! He looked around, who said that? But he saw that there was one of these drains, the manhole was not on it, and he was about to walk right in the hole. And this thing, or whatever it was, had stopped him from injuring himself again. And then a third time it happened, he was about to cross the street, stop! And a truck out of control was careering down the street. For the third time, that thing saved his life. And he asked, who are you? What are you? And he heard the words back, I'm your guardian angel to protect you. I've been protecting you for a long time now. And the man said, yes, But where were you when I got married? It's a mug joke. Anyway, so observing auspicious times for wedding are special events, the ditti. They say if a Buddhist falls into ditti, that person will not attain nibbana. The ditti which you won't attain nibbana is a ditti of like view, think you exist. There's somebody in there. After, it's the last one because it's getting late. After observing lunch meals which come from Asian communities, Sri Lankan, Thailand, Vietnamese, how about Western society? Yeah, why not? So we can have Western food. So where are you Westerners? You got the Thai group coming. You got the Vietnamese. You got the Singaporeans. That's Eddie and Manel. They're Sri Lankan, but Singaporean. So we can have the Westerners tomorrow. Well, what Westerners can we have? Shall we have the Norwegians and have Japanese whale meat? That's what they eat there. How about Eskimos? What do Eskimos eat? Blubber. Well, wait. That's why we don't have Western food. No, whatever, anyway. How could monastery can develop in Western countries without society like Asian, which has culture of serving Sangha and practitioners? Thanks to all nice meals from people who drive far away. Come on, Oz, it says in the end. And it is actually true that when you start monasteries in these countries, it's the Asian communities who usually feed the monks first of all. Many Thais and Sri Lankans, Malaysians also come in there. But you know, eventually the Westerners come in, and many Westerners come and bring food. You go down to Bodhinyana Monastery, you see them bringing food. And also here, you see Westerners bringing food and making food. Bianca. You know, what about her? She's Australian, so she does Oz food. So we're here, but sometimes we just don't notice them. So the Oz people are here. Anyway, who is Australian anyway? Are you Australian? I don't know, but all these Sri Lankans and Burmese and Vietnamese, they're Australian as well. Some of them are more Australian than the Australians are. I remember the Vietnamese. There's one Vietnamese monk over in Monastery San Tuti, and he's got this book by this Vietnamese comedian. And he's really Australian. But I remember one of his favourite jokes was when he was young, just came over as a refugee, and he came home from school and asked his dad, Dad, we're all talking about IQ, what's IQ? And his dad said, well, you know, if you've got an IQ about sort of 120, you're pretty smart. You may go to university. 150, I mean, you're a genius. You'd really go to university, a big one. Most of us got about IQ of 100. That's the average. If you're 80, you know, you're a bit dumb. Maybe you get a job, you know, as a street sweeper or a politician or something. And if you've got an IQ of, say, 60, you're so stupid, you probably won't even be able to tie your own shoelaces. To which the Vietnamese boy said, ah, that explains why Australians wear thongs. It's a really good joke. So he can get away from it, really, because he's an Australian Vietnamese. So, yeah, I mean, these days, I mean, what country do you belong to? You know, are you UK? Are you Australian? You know, are you Polish? Are you sort of Sri Lankan? Are you sort of Malaysian, Chinese? What are you anyway? And a lot of us get so confused we don't know who we are. Isn't that nice? Which means you don't belong anywhere, but you belong everywhere. So our world is getting like that. We're getting all mixed up. So it doesn't really matter. We don't identify with any country anymore. Because we have friends who are Sri Lankan, Burmese, Australian, Polish. Who have I missed out? Indian. People actually from all over the world come to this retreat. So it's great that, you know, come from many, many places, Indonesia. Which means that we can all just be one happy, meditating, retreat, yogis, families. So that way, I don't really look at nations anymore. Whoever brings the food, as long as it's something I like, they're my country. So anyway, there is the talks for tonight. There is all the... And please remember, only one question each. There's a lot of questions. I usually get even more every evening. So, now is the time for doing what I call more meditation. This is the time for meditating flat out. You know how to meditate flat out? Yeah, on your bed, yes. And see if, when you let go, because Ananda, the story of Ananda, he was trying so hard to get enlightened. The following day, they were going to have this big conference of 500 fully enlightened arahats. And actually, there was only 499, and one was left out. That was Ananda. He was just a streamer. He wasn't enlightened yet. And you can imagine what it might feel like. I usually say, imagine it was the last day of this retreat, and I say, all of you are fully enlightened except you. How would you feel? Oh, you feel terrible. It's like the peer pressure, keeping up with the Joneses. If everyone else is enlightened, I've got to get enlightened too. And that's what Ananda felt. So he gave it everything he got. Stayed up all night, meditating, walking and sitting and walking and sitting. And by the dawn, he hadn't got anywhere. As stupid as when he started. He'd blown it. He was about an hour's time. He was going to go to the conference as the only unenlightened member. But who cares? He tried everything. So he decided just to take a nap. He went to his room. And according to the tradition, just before his head hit the cushion, he was fully enlightened. And we call that the Ananda method of enlightenment. Lying down. And see if that happens to you. Just before your head hits the cushion, you become enlightened. If it doesn't work, then try again. Try many times during the day. Flat out meditation. So have a good break. Those of you who've got energy, carry on meditating. Those who are tired, go and take a break. And we'll see you in the morning. Another day. Another opportunity for enlightenment. You're on holiday, on retreat. Enjoy every moment. But now is the time for flat out meditation. Doing your pressing business. Pressing your mattress. Okay, have some nice rest. See you tomorrow.